Welcome to The Process Podcast, an interview series focused on the process of survival as a creative. Season 6 features conversations with visual artists and curators and gallerists from the Bay Area of California. These conversations took place during a 3-month-long residency at the Growlery, an incredible organization based in San Francisco, who facilitated many of these conversations. They can be found at thegrowlery.org. We have also launched a Patreon for those who want to and are able to provide some financial support for the show to help us keep going. You can learn more about why we've launched that and where the money goes and how it will help us grow at patreon.com/theprocessco. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you dig the season. Cheers, y'all.
Hi. Hello.
This episode is with Nima Gobier, who was a fellow resident at the Growlery with me at the beginning of this year. Nima is a San Francisco Bay Area artist who creates art that explores her identity as a Black woman. Through paintings and installations, her work teases out both the nuances and shared experiences of being Black. Her work draws on text and photo references collected from family and personal archives. Nima also received a master's from Harvard in education with an emphasis on art education, and is really committed to both her art practice as well as her career as an educator, which you'll hear us talk a lot about, as well as a lot about identity, identifying as an artist, as well as the ways in which she puts her identity into her art. And we also talk about the process of her coming into her own space artistically and stylistically, her need and drive to balance art with other intellectual interests such as political science and teaching, the importance of distilling a sense of identity in children early on, and what she's doing with the students that she works with to help do that. How her passion for working with children of color drives her to move forward in an industry that promises to not pay fairly. How she balances and makes time for teaching and creating art. And how she thinks about her internal needs to nurture as it relates to her career. And a whole lot more. Since speaking to Nima earlier this year, and you'll hear in this episode, she was very much in a phase of transition in her life. Kind of looking for the next thing, figuring out where she was going to work and all of that. And since we talked, she has taken a full-time position at YR Media, formerly known as Youth Radio, as their education producer and project manager. And she just got the Emerging Artist Professionals Fellowship a few weeks ago. So big congrats to Nima. That is what's up with her lately. Nima is one of the most lovely people I have ever met. She is a joy to talk to. You will hear us laughing a lot in this episode. I was cracking up laughing as I was editing it. Really dug it. I hope you do too. Please find links to Nima's work as well as everything else we talked about, like Root Division and the Growlery, at theprocess.co. And if you dug it, feel free to share it with a friend. Thank you for being here and for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, y'all.
My name is Nima, and I am a painter, an embroiderer, and I draw.
Mm-hmm. An artist, if you will.
Yes, some call me an artist. Most of the time I call myself an artist.
How long have you identified as an artist?
Well, probably I started doing art when I was really, really young. I think the first art memory I have is actually sitting with my dad, and we were making those little like flippy animations where you like draw an animation on one page, then draw another one that's like slightly different, and you like flip it back and forth really fast.
OG GIFs.
Basically.
Yeah, I love those flipbook things.
Yeah. And I was like 4, maybe. Yeah. I got into kindergarten really early. Okay. So I was drawing from an early age, and my parents were always really supportive, so.
Are they artists?
My mom is not. My dad probably wouldn't call himself an artist, but he was pretty good at drawing little cartoons.
How would you describe your style today? Can you talk about some of the themes you've been working on, and then we'll kind of work our way backwards again?
Yeah. So like I said, I'm a painter, mostly portraiture, and I do a lot of embroidery, and I feel like the embroidery part of my painting is maybe the more abstract part of it. Although like my earlier work, the embroidery like took the form of flowers. Now it's kind of just like shapes and forms, lots of lines and patterns. There's a little bit of text in my work now too. A little all over the place. Yeah. This is my first year with studio space, so a lot of my recent work has been figuring out what it looks like to have an art practice outside of a school, outside of like instruction and guidance and actual projects that you're supposed to be working on that are given to you.
Right. Mm. What has that process looked like for you?
It's been a lot. It's been really freeing. It's been really nice to make like bad work and be like, that is terrible. And like also with no deadlines, you can like leave something and come back to it months later. Yeah. Having studio space makes a huge difference. And it's also been really nice just having that space to just like everything that I make is completely mine. So when people are like, you should do this or you should do that, like I'm so elated to be like, no, I won't. And I like don't have to. So it's been nice. Highly recommend it.
Is that confidence very intrinsic for you? Because I know like for me, if someone's like, I don't know, I'll like take it too much. I'll like think about it too much.
It's not super intrinsic for me. Like I've been seeing it in other areas of my life where it does kind of like affect the way that I think about things. But with art, maybe it comes with having like the studio space too, where like I really don't feel an obligation to other people or other people's ideas, especially as like a Black woman making art. Like I always think about like, should my art be more political or should it be like more social justice centered? It doesn't have to be any of those things. I feel like sometimes it is without me trying just because of like the nature of my identity, but it's completely my own and I want to keep it that way, because as soon as it's not, then it's work,
right? And not expression.
Yeah, it's like a project with an agenda, and it's nice to have a space where there's no agenda.
Yeah, totally. I really love your, I forget the name of it, but the overheard, the one with the phrases that you've either like are thoughts or you've overheard, and you don't differentiate between those for viewers, right? Like no one knows if it's something that you thought or something that you overheard, right?
Yeah,
I love that.
Thanks. Yeah, that's been actually really fun to make, and it has been part of the coming into my own space process, because it's a lot of managing past things and how it kind of fits into the current situation and the way that I'm processing things now. It's been a good way to organize my thoughts, and also all this stuff that I've archived like a weirdo for the past few years.
Yeah, where did they come from, and like how did you keep that archive? Like iPhone notes?
Yeah, a lot of iPhone notes. A lot of I journal a lot. Like I've been journaling a lot for the past like 5 or 6 years. And I also, I think because I journal a lot, like when I hear people say things, like I write them down, usually in a sketchbook, sometimes on my phone. They're out all over the place. Sometimes I run into them and I'm like, I didn't even know I was keeping things there, like weird Excel sheets in my Google Drive, scraps of paper.
Yeah, I was actually really inspired by that. I was like, I need to, because I like, I don't know, listen on to people's conversations a lot. I think everyone does. So I was like, I wish I kept like a little journal of things that I heard. At least to bring back memories, if nothing else.
Yeah. It's also weird to think that, like, people really do speak in, like, weird little poems.
Yeah.
Like, even Kija, she was talking about, like, flowers that were on the table. And she was saying that she needed to put water in them. And she was like, oh, yeah, like, they're still alive, though. Like, as alive as you can be when you're not rooted to the ground. And I was like, that is so beautiful. Yeah. And she was like, what are you saying? And it's written on a piece of paper somewhere.
Yeah, that is beautiful. Yeah. It's so poetic.
Yeah, Kija is poetic.
When did you get into embroidery?
I remember embroidering when I was in elementary school with those little Klutz books. Do you remember those? Mm-hmm. They were like these weird little project books where they would like give you like a tiny packet of things, okay, and then they would have like different things you could do.
Yeah.
Like one of them was making paperclip jewelry with pliers, okay, and one of them was embroidery. One of them was learning how to like sew things. They're pretty cutesy. I think that's the first time I did it. I was a crafty little kid, so okay, it feels kind of intuitive.
You went to graduate school too, right?
Yeah.
Undergrad. Yeah. What did you go to school for?
I went to school for education with a focus in arts education.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that a little bit. Like, walk me through how your life works. How you make money, how you are to where you are today, the fellowship, all of it.
Yeah. How far? Should we go all the way back to undergrad or?
Yeah.
Okay. So I majored in studio art and peace and conflict studies in my undergrad. And from there, I did a Fulbright in India teaching English, but it was an arts-based English teaching program that I was doing. And I always thought I was going to work internationally. I went into undergrad with an arts major, and then I added peace studies later because I kind of wanted to do something else, like have something to balance the art practice, I guess. And it always felt like I did feel really unbalanced years that I took more political science classes than art classes. Like, I feel like I really needed both. But after being in India for a year, I didn't want to stay abroad. Working abroad as a Black woman is really, really hard. And I came into that hard.
Do you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yeah. I feel like, what can I say about that?
To like a lot of misogyny and racism?
Yeah, basically.
Just like the way people talk to you, or was it also like the way you were paid? How did...
It was mostly the way that I interacted with what was around me, like a lot of staring, a lot of questioning of my nationality, a lot of, yeah,
constantly
sexual harassment.
To, like,
yeah, just okay. The whole gamut. And I don't think that that's unique to, I was in India at the time, like that happens in the US too.
Totally.
But it is, it feels different coming from people who are also people of color.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I was shell-shocked, and I probably shouldn't have been, but...
I mean, it's tough not to be, even if you're told something like that. I'd imagine even if you're like warned in advance, it's still jarring in the worst type of way. Right?
Yeah, very visceral.
Yeah.
And it was like, it felt like work being outside. But teaching actually and like being in the classrooms was the best part of that experience and was really fun and was like a big crash course in just like being a full-time teacher.
Have you been a full-time teacher since?
So I did that, and then I was actually a barista in San Francisco the year after that and was working at Children's Hospital in Oakland. Mm. They keep an artist in residence on staff, so
cool.
I was working there, and that was a lot of fun, and that's how I found out about Harvard's program, the Arts and Education program. So I ended up there.
Is that where you went to grad school?
Yes.
Oh, fancy.
Slip that right
that's,
in.
Yeah, I got the Ivy League.
Yeah. That's where I did my graduate degree.
And what was the program again?
It's a master's in education, but they have, I think it's 14 different strands, and I was in the arts education strand. And that one's pretty eclectic. Like, you can do that program doing music, doing performing arts, spoken word, visual arts.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like, being there?
Oh, it was a lot. I like being in school, and I like reading. I am really, really nerdy. Mm. So I loved that, but then it was also really difficult to, like, carve out time to have, like, your art practice, because that's not necessarily what the program is all about. And because it was such an eclectic program, no one's telling you, like, focus on your studio time necessarily. You really have to be able to do that for yourself. And so it was good for me to figure out how to do that, especially when I was so busy. Like, there's so many things to do in a grad program like that, and you have a lot of opportunities, and you also have to kind of like keep yourself centered.
I feel like this is a fucked up question, so I apologize if it is. So I know we've talked about like being broke artists, air quotes,
yes,
in the Bay Area. Is it sometimes like you're like, I have a fucking graduate degree from Harvard. Why am I a broke artist? Like, what is that?
Yeah, I am like that. It's, the thing that really sucks is that I have a master's in education, emphasis in arts education, and the jobs that are around arts education, I'm not going to name any names, even though I want to. Like, I've been applying for jobs, and people want to pay you like $20 an hour to be a director of their art program for their pretty well-known like nonprofit organization. So it's interesting that there's a graduate degree for something that promises, like almost promises not to pay you well.
Yeah.
And so like I found myself this past, I've been home for about 6 months now from Boston, and I've had like four different things going on, and it feels like I work 7 days a week. And I am lucky to like love what I do and like love working with kids and love making art, but it's exhausting.
Yeah. Did anyone bring that up when you were going to school for?
Totally. Let the record show that I'm nodding. The funny thing is, so I'm 25. I just turned 25 a couple months ago. I went into that grad program when I was 23, and a lot of people who were there were like in their 30s. And so they'd been in the field for a while. They'd been teaching for a while. And a lot of what was coming up was people saying that they did have to kind of piece together things, and they were doing a lot of things. And me, as like a young grad student who didn't have as much work experience, I was just like, just don't do that. And like now being out here and like kind of circling back to it, I kind of see how you fall into that, and like you're kind of guided into doing that, and you have to do that to get by.
Yeah.
And like here I am like not paying any rent at the gallery, and I'm like trying to save money, trying to figure out next steps.
But dude, it's awesome that you've found these things now. I wish I did this when I, well, no regrets, blah, blah, blah. But a big part of me wishes I did this stuff when I was 25. 25, I was like working away, like just trying to make a buck, doing stuff that I don't care about, you know, that like it doesn't mean us, it all formed me or whatever. But yeah, I'm happy that you're at least taking advantage of it now. Like doing things like worrying about saving money, and those things do matter.
Oh gosh, tough to do. It's all like thoughts right now. We'll see if it actually happens.
So what drives you, not the art in particular, but the arts and education, knowing that some of these folks working in those areas aren't paid what they should be paid and what they deserve? And
I think what drives me, I am particularly passionate about working with children of color, like specifically Black and Brown kids, because I grew up in a predominantly white area, and I didn't start drawing pictures of people who looked like me until way, way later. Wow. And I feel like that's such an important thing to do, to like examine your identity and like how you process and fit into the world and reimagine the world. And if that could have happened sooner for me, that would have been incredible. And it can happen sooner for a lot of the kids in the Bay Area. And public schools are cutting like arts education, like the first thing that they cut. And so I'm particularly interested in like nonprofits that kind of try and get in there and offer an artistic outlet for kids of color. And because that has been such a formative experience for me, like making art about me and my family and my thoughts and the way that I'm processing the world, like I really want every kid to have that opportunity as much as I can be a part of that. And that feels like if I'm not doing that, like I don't quite know what else I would be doing.
Do you share your work with the kids that you work with, like with your, because it's so much about your identity and with people of color and the hair and the everything. Is that something you share with them, or do you more just talk about it and encourage them to like think outside the box?
Right now I'm teaching first and second grade, and they haven't seen my work yet. And I think I will show them my work, because it's funny, we were working on like a little weaving project, and I embroidered a lot 3 or 4 years ago and like kind of just started doing it when I introduced it to them. So my teaching and my art practice really complement each other and feed into each other. So it would make sense that they would see kind of, you're doing this and like I'm also doing this, and like in a few years you can maybe be doing this in a studio if you want to.
Right. Yeah. Would you ever want to be like a voice for advocating for the art, like a prominent voice advocating for the arts and schools and children of color? Like, is that, I'm trying to think of how to like make you some money doing this.
I was thinking about that too, and I was talking to some teachers that came through, I think Keija's birthday party actually, about how like what our board's like and like who like actually influences. And it kind of seemed, it was a little discouraging. She was like, it's a little bit of a mess. Like, you can have, like, a board person, like, pass this rule, but, like, really things get implemented, like, on an individual level, like, at schools. And I don't want to be, it's a weird balance where, like, if you're on the more administrative side of things, you're not in classrooms. And if you're, like, in classrooms, you're usually not on, like, the administrative side of things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I haven't quite figured out how that's going to work. And in terms of like nonprofits, outreach and recruiting, I guess, is kind of an in that way. Still just exploring different options. There's so many.
Totally.
And also I need people to hire me. Yeah. And then pay me.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. Going back to Boston, this might be me being ignorant, but when I think of Boston, I think of it as a very white place.
Yeah.
Well, what is it being, how does it feel being like a person of color in Boston now? Like, what was that experience for you?
I was really close to the campus. I was living in Cambridge. So it kind of is, I think Boston is very white and it makes me appreciate the Bay Area. Cambridge is a weird bubble because it has like MIT, Harvard, and like a bajillion other schools, weirdly. It's a good mix. And like being around this school, I think spoiled me a lot. They're amazing, amazing, specifically women of color in the ed program. And so it was easy to get inspired and like easy to feel kind of incubated. And then when you kind of like get out of that bubble, even being in like the Bay Area, you kind of realize how this, like it was a microcosm, very like nurturing, nice microcosm where you worked really hard.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Are you from Walnut Creek?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So yeah.
And that's considered, I don't know where that is. Where is Walnut Creek?
It's like in the East Bay.
Okay.
Yeah. Like very inland.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience here as an artist of growing up here and like your time as an adult?
Yeah, so I was lucky. Walnut Creek, actually, their civic arts program is the biggest civic arts program in Northern California. And I don't know exactly how that plays into their public schools. I went to public school, but I always had arts education available. And that's 100% why I'm an artist today, like because it was offered and like continuously offered. I kept taking arts programs and supportive parents. Going through arts education as a young kid and kind of like booping around with like peace studies and education and then coming back to San Francisco, I came back here for Root Division to do their Blau Gold Fellowship, which kind of combines teaching and art because they give you a studio. It feels like it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really nice to have a studio. And it's also made me realize that there should be a lot more programs like that because I know so many teachers who can't balance their teaching lives and their art lives. Like those shouldn't really be things that you have to compromise in order to have one or the other. So I'm really grateful to be able to do both. And it's set up my mind and thinking about how I can do both and like I actually can do both and like making sure that's a priority.
How did you get the fellowship? Like how did that come about?
So an alum from Harvard who lives in the Bay Area, I think he works with UC Berkeley now, but he worked at Root Division and told me about the fellowships. And so I applied at the end of the year, came back for an interview, and then found out that I got it. And it seemed to really make sense. I was actually working as a research assistant for this research project called Talking with Artists Who Teach. Mm-hmm. And so like in my mind already, I was thinking about like how artistic practice and personal practices like can actually coexist. And finding an opportunity that reinstated that was like amazing.
Can you tell me what you would tell someone? Like, how would you encourage someone to combine those things today? Like,
ooh, yeah.
If I was a visual artist, or even not being a visual artist, I guess.
If you're gonna teach and also make things, I think you have to, what works for me usually is like blocking out time in my calendar. And so like you're teaching like let's say 7 to 2 p.m. If you're doing that, then figure out what you're doing after class and then like figure out when you're going to be in your studio that week. And I'm a visual person, obviously. And so like seeing my studio time color is purple, like blocks of purple is helpful for me to understand like how much time am I putting into this studio. And then also you have to like give yourself a little bit of grace too, because there are some weeks when I only get to the studio once and I feel that. And then like next week is different. And so you're not going to be like completely balanced all the time. But I think just being honest with yourself and like where you are in that balance is really important. And it's not easy. No. But like if art is something that you like doing, like it will make you feel better to have it in your life.
Right. And you can only start with a small amount of time.
Yeah.
Age old.
Yeah.
Minutes a day.
Yeah, just like a little bit. And I think it's important to, if it is in your practice, to like have shows on your calendar. Like Kija was awesome and was like, do you want to have a show like in January? And I was like, that's terrifying. Yes.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. I think that it's important too, right? Saying yes to some of the stuff that scares you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Highly recommended.
I also love the, I'm a nerd about time blocking.
Yeah.
Live and die by it, or else I would never accomplish anything.
Yeah, me too.
Cool. So do you think you'll stay? Are you trying to stay in the Bay Area? Is this like going to be home for a while? Or
Ooh.
Is this where you're applying to jobs?
That's a good question. And I ask myself that like before I go to bed every night. I think that Root Division is keeping me here until end of June.
Okay.
And I think that's a good thing because I have a tendency to like flee or I don't know. It's hard to tell if you're running away from something or running to something.
Yes. I relate to that in a big way.
Yeah. So I'm happy that I'm anchored here for a while because otherwise I might have run by now because I feel like I'm coming to, with the end of the Growlery, the show having finished, and like I just finished this contract with Youth Radio or now Wire Media. And so it seems like a good stopping point, but I have 6 more months. So we're kind of going to see what happens in the next 6 months.
Cool. Mm-hmm. What do you do with the media company?
So I was working with their curriculum. They are an organization that kind of supports storytelling, mostly focusing on journalism, media, arts, with predominantly students of color. They're based in Oakland, and mostly with 14 to 24-year-olds. And so I was like packaging their curriculum for them. We were having like a webinar series, and then I was also making these educational toolkits with little illustrations. It was really fun. It's a great organization.
Awesome. I guess we've already kind of covered how you make it work, but can you elaborate any, like, on how you make it work financially? And
I'm not even sure if I'm like making it work necessarily.
That's like, important. Make note of it.
Living on a prayer every day of my life.
Yeah.
But also not really, because I'm so lucky. Like I'm lucky enough to have a really good relationship with my mom who will let me like move back in. I'm lucky that Root Division like set up this residency with the Growlery. I am lucky to have gotten like contract work, and I'm also lucky to be doing what I like to do.
Yeah.
So it's not like draining me.
Can I ask if you have student debt?
Oh yeah, I do. I did pay off my undergraduate debt, which is fantastic, but I have like almost all of the debt from Harvard, which was, it was a year-long program, so it's not terrible, but like I do have making those monthly payments.
Most artists I have met, like fine artists I have met, go to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's like outside of obviously for education you gotta go, but just to be an artist, like do you have an opinion on how important graduate school is?
Like getting a like an MFA?
Yeah, I guess.
I have some thoughts on it and probably can't speak too much on it since I don't have one, but it seems like everyone who I've talked to who has an MFA kind of talks about how it's basically a time where like it's an incredible growth period, and also you're just around people who are like, yeah, you're focusing on your art and like that's important and you need to do that. And I don't think you find that anywhere else really. Yeah, especially since, like, even if you're just a full-time artist, it's such a hustle. I think the world is constantly telling you that you have to do art and something else. Like, I do art and something else, but I hate the idea that, like, you have to be like that. Like, sometimes, or it would be nice to just be able to be an artist. And I think that's difficult. But I think having the space where people tell you, like, this is important and, like, this is worth pursuing, that happens in like your MFA program. It didn't really happen for me at Harvard. People were like, make sure you read your article. So I don't know if I'll get an MFA, but I think it's incredible to pursue.
You, if given the opportunity, you would maybe be just focused on your art?
Me personally, I don't think so. I've been challenged a lot on that, because some people who are at Harvard had MFAs and were coming back for MEDs. And one woman in particular was like, why don't you have an MFA? And I do think that, I'm trying to figure out how to say it correctly, I feel like most women have a lot of trouble being focused on their stuff and like stuff being an art practice in this case. And
selfish, right?
Yeah.
Because that's how we're programmed.
Right. Yeah. And it's totally okay to be selfish. And also there's like a weird line between selfish and self-care. And
I don't think it actually is selfish.
Right. To like focus on like something that feeds you. And so I do kind of wonder, like, I think that's completely valid. Like, why do I feel pulled to be in schools? And I do think, like, I love being in schools. And, like, that's not – I don't think the only reason I'm in schools is because of, like, my maternal need to nurture. But it's interesting to think about.
Can you talk a little bit about your actual practice when it comes to creating your work and, like, any routines you have, if any, like, how that works?
Yeah. Do I have routines? I feel like I was taught, I oil paint mostly now. And oil painting, I think, is funny because however you're taught how to oil paint, it really sets up your practice. Because I think that everyone oil paints kind of differently. I don't know, some people use medium, some people don't use medium, some people like use color straight out of the tube, like all kinds of weird things you can do. My teacher was very methodical, and so I feel like even though I'm not a methodical person, I'm kind of a hot mess. Like, I do have, like, kind of a weird methodical way of, like, I mix my palette before I start painting, and, like, I used to be really intense about, like, reference photos for my paintings because I mostly do portraiture. And I think that's breaking down a little bit as I just come into my own stuff. I work pretty small, so I don't plan out my paintings beforehand. Like, a lot of people do pre-sketches, and I don't, but I just got these really big canvases, and I am worried about not planning those out because they're so, so big.
Yeah.
So we'll see how I tackle those. They're just staring at me in my studio right now.
How big are they?
They're 5 feet by 6 feet.
Wow.
And I have not painted bigger than 3 by 3 feet.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Cool challenge.
Yeah. It's exciting. They were so cheap. They're $30 each.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's like the norm.
I think those ones are supposed to be around $180. They have a broken crossbar on the back, but like you can fix it in like 10 minutes with a staple gun.
Yeah.
And they're actually supposed to be on sale for $50, but then the woman at Blick didn't know how to like enter in the price. And she's like, how does 30 sound? And I was like crying. I was like, that sounds so good.
Like the normal art store.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
How do you choose whose portrait you're gonna paint? Where does that come from?
Ooh, that's so my older series of work, that's all family, like me and my sister basically. Kind of the newer things, the process for that is that like I have all of these like weird quotes and lines that I've collected. I'll like write them down kind of big on a piece of paper and they're stuck all over my wall like a serial killer.
Like your embroidery string.
Yeah, like lines. And I'll like kind of pick one that's like speaking to me at the time, like whatever that means. And it'll like be written really big on a canvas. And so I think the one that's up in my studio right now that I just started painting on says, the humility of knowing you can always love someone better. And so that'll be really big. And then kind of, I also archive a lot of images, mostly taken from my film camera. I like thinking about things as kind of overlapping. Like I take a lot of film camera pictures and like I don't really print them or use them, but like sometimes they'll match really well with like something that I've written down from something else. And so it's kind of looking for those weird patterns in like what I collect and seeing how they kind of circle back to each other. And so I think I mostly take portraits, and I also take a lot of portraits on my iPhone too. So I can't quite describe the logic of matching them together, but I feel like some of them do match. And then when they do, like I paint usually pretty quickly, and then the text is brought out with the embroidery at the end.
What drew you to picking up a film camera?
So my undergraduate degree in art was really, you had to take all different disciplines, and then you had a junior show and a senior show. And so I got a film camera for my 19th birthday, took the intro film photo class as one of my requirements, and then got a job in the dark room just because the teacher liked me and I really liked being in the dark room. And I could also be in there like 24/7 because my key card could swipe in at any time. I could also like take everyone's like old paper because some people like wouldn't continue to take film after. So I got like incubated by the availability of materials and like space and time. Like during my shift, I would just develop things. And I don't develop anymore, but I kind of keep the pattern of, since my film camera is mine, I wasn't renting it from the school, just like taking pictures every once in a while. So I just have like a lot of pictures of times when I happen to have my film camera. I think I develop maybe 4 rolls a year.
Okay.
Yeah, so not super often.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah,
it's just expensive. It's so expensive. Yeah. And it's getting more expensive.
Yeah. I remote has been great, being able to do it myself.
Yeah.
That's my next cost money too, but
yeah, but
as much as it does most places, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, two more questions for you.
Okay.
One is, if you had to give a piece of advice, I don't know, to your, like, what's your biggest insight or lesson that you've like really reflected on? I guess question.
In having an art practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's that, I mean, working with kids and like working in as myself, I feel like just having any kind of art practice is so important. And like, I do think it's like a pillar of humanness. Humanity is maybe the word. Like, I see my students, and like, not all of my students like making visual artwork. They had this little assembly performance they had to do, and like one of my students who's like really really all over the place, like doesn't really pay attention in class, was dancing on stage and was like completely into dancing and like on beat and like so feeling it, and I was like, that's his thing.
Yeah.
And like, I think that if you're not creating, like you will feel off, or at least I feel off. I guess it's weird to universalize it, but I don't think there's any person who's like, I hate all types of art. Like, I hate writing, I hate reading, I hate dancing.
Right.
Like, who is that person? And I think it's not.
But most people don't make time for it. Well,
yeah.
I can't say most, but it feels like most.
It seems that way. And I also think that, like, people think artists are these weird mystical beings. And, like, I make really bad things, like, very often. I think it's sometimes just a numbers game. And, like, sometimes things turn out good. And, like, working on things is important. There are just so many like different lessons you can learn from art, and like lessons different people can learn from art. And I want everyone to be able to create things, not just visually, but like in any way possible, because it's so important. Like, I don't know how to say it any other way. Just do it.
Yeah. My darkroom instructor laughed at me for calling photography a numbers game.
I'm sure.
He's like, yeah, wait, what?
I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of sass about that too, because then that gets into like, but what about your technical skill? And like, I am really good at like rendering things that look like things. And so it depends on what you're going for. But I do think that we are all artists, and a lot of people don't think that. But I think that people should be making bad stuff and sometimes good stuff.
Totally. The good stuff comes out of the bad stuff, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. What is something you're excited about today?
I'm moving out of the gallery today. I'm not excited about it. I'm excited about, I guess today is like the big transition day to like whatever's coming next. And I can't jump forward in time or like peek forward in time, and I really want to. And like, I have to write out this transition. I'm trying to be excited about what comes next. And the fact that I literally don't know what's coming next is pretty exciting. At least it's not mundane. So I'll say that.
Do you get a lot of comments about like how happy you seem? And how smiley and laughy you are?
I do.
Or you're not. You don't portray the tortured artist.
I really don't.
Not to say you don't have emotions and feelings.
I get that, especially having gone to, like, when I said that I got into Harvard, people were like, like, what? Because I'm, like, not, like, very, I don't seem very academic either, I guess, because I do smile a lot. But the idea that, like, academics and artists are, like, these broody, unhappy people, and, like, not to say I don't have a lot of emotions.
Right.
But I do get that a lot, and people are like, you're so whimsical and friendly, and I'm like, okay.
Do you feel that way, or are you just like, I'm just me?
I guess so.
Do you feel like it portrays, like, how you feel?
I think that, like, especially, like, right now, like, during this weird, squishy time, I don't feel happy all the time. I do think that it's easier to feel happy with other people. So I think that's a lot of what people are getting.
Okay, I guess that's what I was trying to ask, yeah.
Yeah, like, I find most people, like, very interesting. And so I guess it makes sense that when I encounter people, they're like, whoa, you're, like, really, like, bubbly. Yeah. But, like, when I'm, like, not feeling my best and I'm alone in my studio, like, that's when, like, the weird, like, the weird things that you see embroidered on the canvas, like, it's coming out of mostly that space.
That'd be really funny if, because your art's bright, it's mm-hmm. colorful. It'd be really funny if your art was, like, dark. People, like, meet you and then they see your art, they're like, oh.
Just different, like, black canvases.
Circles, black holes.
Welcome to my psyche.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Of course. Thanks for interviewing me.
Yeah, my pleasure.